You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
We are holding this panel to mark the publication of Assassination of the Saint, the plot to murder Oscar Romero, and the quest to bring his killers to justice. By Matt Eisenbrat, who is sitting immediately to my left. Matt Eisenbrat is a lawyer. He served as legal director for the Center for Justice and Accountability, an organization based in San Francisco that has played a leading role in efforts to promote accountability for gross human rights abuses, and has particularly focused on the abuses that took place in El Salvador and Guatemala. Matt today works for the Canadian Center for International Justice, so he's still engaged in the same struggle. And then to his left is Patty Blum, an attorney who has played a leading role, perhaps the leading role, in the litigation of the Center for Justice and Accountability. And she is clinical professor of law emerita at the University of California at Berkeley, and she is also today, the director of the Human Rights Institute at Cardozo Law School here in New York. And to her left at the other end of the table, and I'm going to begin with him, is Ray Bonner. Ray is an investigative journalist who has reported from all over the world, but like it or not, he is permanently associated in the minds of many of us who recall that period with his work in El Salvador at the time of the beginning of the armed conflict in El Salvador. And Ray, I wonder if you would start us off by talking about what it was like to be a journalist in El Salvador at that time. And I'll ask a sort of follow-up question at the same time. We're at a moment where the President of the United States is engaged in certain attacks on journalists, and I wonder if that calls to mind any of your own experiences. So, Ray?
Yeah. Well, thank you. And Matt, congratulations on a terrific book, and even more for your work with CJA and pursuing accountability. And Patty, the same thing. I mean, we forget these things. They're so easy for me to forget. I mean, it's what, 40 years ago at least, and it's good that you don't forget and you hold some of these people accountable, and I truly applaud both of you for the work that you do. What was it like? Well, I arrived in El Salvador. I was a lawyer doing this kind of work. Dropped out, went to Central America, got to El Salvador on Sunday. The nuns were killed on Tuesday. The rest is history. So I got there shortly after Romero had been killed, I mean, 6-8 months later. It's hard to believe now, some of you will remember this, but those of you who are younger, it's hard to believe Central America was the biggest foreign policy issue at the time. I mean, it was as big then as the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, you name it, is now. This was where the Reagan administration was, quote-unquote, going to draw the line against the advance of communism. So it was a big story, although it didn't become a big story until they killed the American churchwomen. Until that time, 10,000 Salvadorans had been killed in 1980. I think that was the number, something like that. We didn't pay a lot of attention. And then when they killed the Americans, you can see a bit of cynicism in my voice. when they killed the Americans, then it became a big story. Yes, the press, I did come under attack by the Wall Street Journal and the Reagan administration. But I just read something before I came here about Jack Schaefer, about the attacks on the press now. And his last line was, quit whining, just go out and write another story. And that's kind of the way I felt at the time. And I felt kind of privileged. And I'm not saying this in some kind of a arrogant way. I mean, I felt, all right, they'll say what they want to say, and I'll go out and write another story. I remember the movie Continental Divide. I think it's based on Mike Royko. You know, he was the same way. You know, they come after you, go write another story. And I think that was the attitude then. And it was easy also being so far away. You weren't here. You didn't see it day after day. It wasn't in your face. And we didn't have mobile phones. We weren't reading everything every minute. So I basically didn't know what was going on back in the United States. And it made it easier to keep going. And it was different for journalists. I'll just say one more thing. Journalism wasn't as dangerous then as it is now. I mean, there were, you know, remember there was the death squad, the hit list of journalists that were supposed to be on, and we made T-shirts, you know, and with a bullet on the back and then the list on the front. I would go running every morning past soldiers with their rifles. After I'd written, well, people have wondered about my sanity for a longer than I've known you are, and certainly ever since. But you know, after I wrote, went in with the guerrillas and wrote about El Masote, I still went back in through the airport. We weren't targeted. There were journalists who were killed in Central America, of course, but journalists weren't targets the way they are now. And you know what I think it changed, Ari, and this is your field. I think it changed with Chechnya when they killed the ICRC workers in Chechnya. And I think that changed. I mean, this is a whole different subject.
There were denunciations the press. And some of that focused on you. Some of that focused on the El Masote story, which was the biggest story of that period.
Yeah, there were, and I remember saying it. I mean, I don't want to make light of it, but I remember saying at the time, look, I give people a hard time. That's my job as a journalist, and so you got to take it. You got to take some of this criticism. But on the other hand, I remember saying that once at the press club in Washington, and Pat Tyler, I mean, he didn't even know him then, but he was the Washington Post at him and said, yeah, but you got to remember it has an effect on everybody because if they can go after a New York Times reporter like this. And I did have people tell me when they went to Central America after me, I'm not going to let happen to me what happened to you.
Well, and there it had was an effect upon the way the New York Times dealt with you.
No, not it's history. It's 50 years ago, 40 years ago. It's not important.
It seemed very important at the time because it significantly affected the Times coverage of what was going on in El Salvador.
Well, it was a Times reporter who said it to me. I'm not going to let happen to you. What happened to you happened to me. So I think you're probably right. And I think, in fact, I was just reading it and looking, I found in my book again that I believe it was the editor of, and it's, I think it was Miami Herald said, you know, don't let this happen to us. So it does have an effect, of course. They know what they're doing, and these attacks are going to have an effect, of course they are. But we just get on with our jobs. We're very privileged. We're very privileged. We can go out and write another story. And I used to think that way. I'd think, all right, I'd go out the next day and go out and find another massacre, another village where there was killing. Anyway,
if you don't mind, I'll give you my own take on this. And that is, there is a certain amount of embarrassment in some of the major media in the way in which you were treated by the New York Times at that time. and that in fact it has helped to stiffen the backbone of the New York Times or other media today, that they have engaged in a level of resistance which is, I think, quite remarkable.
Well, if that's the case, then obviously that's good. We're certainly going to need it.
Okay. Patty Blum, you've been engaged in the effort to hold accountable those who were responsible for gross abuses in El Salvador. Tell us what that has been like.
Thank you, Ari. The first thing I wanted to say, of course, is I'm just completely ecstatic to be here, because Matt, how long was the journey, Matt, of this book?
10 years.
Okay. It was 10 years ago that, Matt said he wanted to write a book about the work that we had done together with others on the assassination of Oscar Romero. And here's this incredible story in this book. And the story, I just want to locate the story a little bit back a few years, which is that when Center for Justice and Accountability was founded in 1998, and it was one of the few kind of human rights non-governmental organizations in the San Francisco Bay Area, I was teaching at Berkeley at the time and approached the new legal director of the center and said, we have to work on El Salvador. And she had been somebody I knew prior to that time. We both had worked on Central American refugee issues in the 1980s. And, you know, here was this opportunity to focus again on El Salvador. And I sort of want to explain just for a minute, like, how that decision was made. I think it's really important to think about, for anybody who does public interest, social justice type law, to be very strategic about the choices you make about what you're going to focus on, because there's always an unbelievable need out there. And the reason why we focused on El Salvador was, I would say, threefold. First of all, because of the Cold War, because essentially the U.S. government had propped up a corrupt military elite in El Salvador for, you know, many, many, many years, but during the most acute period of state terror and repression from 1979 to the end of the conflict when there was a peace agreement in 1992. And, you know, it sounds like chump change or whatever now to say that the U.S. was funding El Salvador to the tune of $1 million a day. But at that point, and as Ray was saying, it was the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid after Israel and Egypt. And it was an incredibly important line in the sand was being drawn in El Salvador that was kind of a, the most representative example of how the Cold War was playing out in a particular region. And I think all of us who had lived through that period had seen the devastation that had happened in El Salvador and knew a lot about it because we had been working with refugees from El Salvador, felt a kind of very compelling sort of moral obligation to the region, since it had been our country that had single-handedly been responsible, essentially, for propping up this regime, which would never have been able to survive not just an armed conflict with organized guerrilla force, but, you know, just would never have had the wherewithal, basically, to carry out what they carried out over the, you know, period of the conflict. And the other thing was, of course, as I was referring to refugees, about a fifth of the population of El Salvador was displaced during that time, and many, many, many tens of hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans and Guatemalans came to the United States and were not received, you know, with open arms by any means. I was involved in one of the big class action lawsuits of that time, which was called the American Baptist Churches versus Thornburg case. And in that case, which was defending sanctuary workers, I mean, this whole history of sanctuary and the way in which it's sort of now been, not starting to be understood as a concept, because of what's happening with the current administration and its attempt to, you know, destroy the notion of sanctuary cities, is that the sanctuary city movement came out of the sanctuary movement, which was a faith-based movement to protect Central American refugees from being forcibly returned to their country. In the 1980s, only less than 3% of Salvadorans were granted asylum, less than 1% of Guatemalans were granted asylum. Arye worked on, when he was like way back in ACLU days or whatever, this amazing first, I remember this report, I think it was in 1982, which was the first report to try to look at what happened to Salvadorans when they were returned to their home country. And so all that history had happened. There was a, you know, huge community of people in the United States, of people who had been forced to flee the conflict. And then amongst them were the top commanders of the Salvadoran military. So it wasn't simply that there were, you know, commingled perpetrators, horrible and tragic for those communities, but in fact, all the top commanders essentially have been given refuge in the United States at the same time. And the third factor, of course, was what was going on in El Salvador, which was that after there was a peace agreement, there was a UN-sponsored truth commission. The UN-sponsored truth commission report came out on, I believe it was March 17th, 1993. I only remember that because it's my birthday. And within 5 days on March 22nd, there was one of the broadest amnesties ever passed in any Latin American country or anywhere in the world. It was a blanket amnesty that basically protected anyone who had committed a human rights abuse during the conflict from criminal prosecution at home. And it wasn't really just that there was an amnesty, but it was also the kind of silencing and the end of any kind of discourse about the impact of this conflict and the abuses people had suffered and the torture that people had suffered and their continued disappeared relatives, of which there were over 10,000 disappeared people. But it was a direct reaction to the fact that the Truth Commission for El Salvador had named names. They had organized the Truth Commission report around 32 exemplar crimes, including the assassination of Archbishop Romero, the assassination of the 6 Jesuit priests, their housekeeper and her daughter, the killing of the church women, the El Mazote massacre, the Rio Simple massacre, these kind of paradigmatic examples. And in the report, they had said who they thought they had sufficient evidence to find had been complicit, either directly or indirectly, as commanders in these crimes. So yeah, there, here's a, like a, the perfect storm from a like public interest perspective of, here's a country where there is no opportunity for any kind of justice in country. Here's a country where a huge part of their population had been hemorrhaged out. Many of people had come to the United States and been protected by, you know, faith-based communities, et cetera. And, you know, we had this role, we, the United States, had this role to play in it. So that's sort of the origin of, that's like Matt's origin story, even though he wasn't actually at CJA at the time this was all happening. And we really kind of did this thing, which, you know, now close to 20 years later, you know, it's, there's sort of like a little cadre of people who, you know, go after some bad guy for like their whole life as a human rights lawyer. You know, and I'm one of those people, and Reed Brody has done that, you know, on the Habre case. And there's a few of us who just like keep after these certain bad guys year after year. And it's a little hard in the current political climate to, you know, feel like, oh, why are you like mired in this past? And like, there's so much wretched stuff going on right now. But there is a way in which this feeling, it sort of gets in your bones, you know, and you meet people along the way who are victims and survivors, and you just remember their stories, and they continue to motivate you. And of course, when I look at El Salvador today, you know, I see all the roots of everything that exists there now in terms of violence, gangs, et cetera, as very much rooted in the kind of institutions that were created by the military and their paramilitary collaborators is sort of springing up in different forms. So anyway, the case that, you know, Matt will talk about was very much part of like a deep commitment that kind of kept snowballing and morphing into different things and trying to have a very holistic approach to the work. There were, you know, three different lawsuits that we were involved in, all of which we were successful. And we after those cases, we then, you know, started lobbying the previously Immigration and Naturalization Service, now Department of Homeland Security, for many, many years to deport the, you know, subjects of our litigation. We succeeded in getting and working with Department of Homeland Security, hard to imagine, but it did happen, to get the two top military commanders of El Salvador, the Minister of Defense from 1979 to 83 and the Minister of Defense from 83 to 89, deported back to El Salvador. And so it's, you know, it's morphed in different directions and using U.S. forums now and using the Spanish National Court as a forum for a case on the Jesuit massacre. I'm not going to go into any of like the case details, but I'm happy to talk about it later. But anyway, that's sort of the broad context in which now, you know, Matt's work on the Romero assassination sort of fits.
And Matt, I'd like you to talk about that and about the book. But Patty, I want to come back to you on the question. I'll give you notice now. Aside from sheer persistence, you know, I'd like you to talk about what you see as the value of pursuing these cases so many years after the crimes took place. Anyway, Matt.
Would you let me to talk about that now? Or
let yeah, Matt okay. talk about
okay, great.
The, and
yes,
then we'll come back to that.
Yes, I'll definitely be very happy to come back to it.
Well, I'll start by thanking everybody up here. Thank you, Ari, for hosting us, and Ray and Patty for being here with us. And there are many people in the audience to thank as well. Sandy Colliver for all your help, and many others who are here. It's great to follow Patty, in part because Patty was not only a trailblazer in the work that I later got to join, but also in helping me craft that story for the book as well, to sort of put the Romero case in the context of the other work that was going on at CJA and elsewhere. The Romero case is interesting in some ways because the result of the case, and we can get into all the details, but the trials that CJA did about El Salvador that bookended the Romero case were in some ways perhaps the direct impact of those cases was perhaps stronger because you had you know, the defendants you know, essentially in the dock, I guess you could say, and we had jury verdicts against the top commanders in the Salvadoran military. The Romero case was in some ways both more limited and more expansive. And what I mean by more limited is that, you know, the story that I tell in the book is partly about the case that we built against Alvaro Saravia for his role in murdering Archbishop Romero. But in fact, the investigation that we did and that we were trying to do was much broader than that, but that is not what came out at trial for a number of reasons that I won't go into right now, but that we talk about, that I talk about in the book. And the Romero trial itself had was perhaps a bit more limited compared to some of these other cases. But the investigation and the broader story of Romero is so much wider, and that was actually part of why I did want to write the book. There was a lot of evidence that we came across, but there was so much evidence that predated any of the work that we ever did at CJA. What I felt was important in the book was to be able to explain some of that, either to people who had forgotten it or never knew it in the first place, and to talk about the work of so many people on the assassination of Archbishop Romero and on investigating that and on reporting on that, that and to put that all into one place and lay all of it out. That was something that I felt, particularly when we launched the investigation at CJA, or when my piece of it came around, was something that was quite impressive to behold. Starting from the day of Romero's assassination and Judge Atilio Ramirez Amaya attempting to investigate that before 3 days later suffering his own assassination attempt and having to flee the country for the next 10 years, all the way through the reporting of Salvadoran reporters, of U.S. reporters, of many others, through U.S. embassy officials, through the Truth Commission, and on and on. And the body of evidence was impressive and stunning before we even came to the case. So what we attempted to do with the case, I think, was try to bring as broad a picture as we could to the Romero assassination, and bring all of that evidence together and build from there. So the case, you know, the way that I talk about it in the book was that we saw our obligation as we had one person, Alvaro Saravia, who was present in the United States, who we knew was involved in Archbishop Romero's assassination, and that was in some ways the hook to then build the case from there. We had a lawsuit directly against Saravia, but Saravia was one of many people involved. And so it was the way to attempt to hold somebody accountable in a U.S. court for Romero's assassination. But we always saw our strategy as being looking at who was above Saravia, essentially. And so when we filed the lawsuit, Saravia was named as a defendant, but we also named DOES 1 through 10. And we intended those DOES to be anybody who was above Saravia, namely people who financed the death squad that Saravia was a member of, Roberto Dobison's death squad, and trying to get at those who were higher up, who were involved either in the murder or at least in supporting Dobison's death squad in a way that might bring legal responsibility. And we saw that as a focus for our investigation for the next year. A big part of why I wrote the book was because at the end of the day, we didn't end up naming anybody else as a defendant in the case. And the trial was only against Alvaro Saravia. There are a number of reasons for that, which I can go into if people want. But I felt like there is a significant body of evidence out there, both evidence that existed before our case and then some witness information that we came across in doing our own investigation. And I wanted to put as much of that on the record as I was able to do, and there's still a lot that I was not able to include in the book. But I wanted to try to lay out what's been publicly discussed, what is perhaps been confidentially out in the ether for a number of years, and what were some of the things that we came across in our own investigation. And tracking our attempt to investigate the financiers or military higher-ups who might have been implicated in Romero's assassination. So that's a theme that runs through the book, is that part of that investigation, which in fact never really ended up in court and never ended up in the public realm. Maybe just to say a few things that I think came out of the Romero case that perhaps are important, and Patty can certainly speak to this as well. You know, I do think the trial itself, with the limits that it had, was important for a few reasons. First of all, it is the only verdict in any court ever about the assassination of Archbishop Romero. And I do think that's important. The judge, our judge, who was a Reagan appointee and a former U.S. Marine, and treated the case very seriously but fairly, concluded that Roberto Davison was the mastermind of the assassination. And that's, I think, an important conclusion, particularly at the time, given the political situation in El Salvador. We have a court verdict against one of the central figures in Roberto Davison's group. I think that's important, and particularly coming from a U.S. federal court. We had the testimony of the getaway driver, Amado Garay, under oath in open court, testifying about Saravia's role in the assassination, his links with, or Garay's links with Roberto Davison in the death squad, and that's all under oath in open court. One of the things that I document toward the end of the book is the chain of events from the trial in our case through the next 6 years, essentially, where Saravia, our defendant, ended up making many important disclosures, culminating eventually in 2010 in Carlos Dada's fantastic article in El Faro, which was the result of extensive interviews with Saravia, and frankly, I think gives us the best record we're probably going to get of the basics of the assassination. And I think that's an important that's been an important product of all the work that came before it. And I do think, and maybe Patty can comment on this later, I do think that the time that the Romero case came through, it did help to continue building the credibility of CJA and of doing these cases in the United States. The case against the two former ministers of defense had come before and clearly was the critical piece in helping us then continue with additional cases. But I do think that the Romero case coming after that on such an important figure like Archbishop Romero on such a difficult investigation, I do think was important then in being able to continue that work on. I mean, Patty would have kept going with it regardless of whether we had that backing or not. But I do think that was an important effect of the case as well. So I'll stop talking there and can get into some other.
And if I could just add a word to what you had to say about the importance of having a judicial finding with respect to Davison. Davison, aside from being a death squad leader, was the founder of the Arena political party, and this was the political party which adopted the amnesty law 5 days after the Truth Commission report, and the Arena political party has continued to be a major factor forming governments in El Salvador. So demonstrating that its founder was the assassin, and doing that in court has extra significance. If I can come back to the question I want to ask Patty, and I'd ask Ray and Matt also to comment on this. What is the importance, as far as you are concerned, of holding accountable those who have been responsible for these kinds of crimes so many years after the crimes took place, aside from the sense of satisfaction for the lawyers pursuing the cases or even for the families of the victims. What do you see as the value of this?
You know, this is, and Arye has written extensively about this in all kinds of, you know, locations, including the New York Review of Books, et cetera, are sort of how you think about these cases and what kind of claims are fair to make about their impact. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of basic ideas about justice, about, you know, a courtroom as a place for truth, et cetera. And I think that I don't want to overclaim what they open up, but I think that El Salvador is a really good example in some ways, especially now with the Salvadoran Supreme Court decision overturning the amnesty law, of a place that, because there was so little possibility for real dialogue in the country, that these lawsuits, which took place with all the like formal imprimatur of U.S. justice, were very important to a process within El Salvador of constantly sort of pushing open the door. And I know Matt certainly doesn't want to claim that he's like personally responsible for Romero becoming a saint. It is true, however, that the case and writing about the case afterwards and continuing to talk about it was a factor among many, many factors that were kind of part of a whole mix that was going on inside and outside El Salvador, around sort of remembrance, keeping the memory alive of the people who were victims, and really also having these very important figures like Romero and the Jesuit priests who were killed in the service of humanity. And so there has been, I think, a real, you know, kind of snowball effect to some extent. And I just want to go back with one little anecdote, which is that prior to doing the case against Generals Garcia and Vitas Casanova, there had been another case on concerning the church women's assassination, in which unfortunately Garcia and Vitas Casanova had not been found liable for that assassination. And there was a huge amount of skepticism and pessimism in El Salvador about, like, why are you people doing this in U.S. courts? And, like, this is just not going anywhere. And if anything, it's vindicating these guys and it's more of the same. And after the lawsuit that I was involved in against these same two generals on behalf of three victims of torture, and we prevailed in that case, I went down to El Salvador, and it was really unbelievable, my experience there. Literally everywhere I went, I was taken around by a priest named John Cortina, who was a friend of Romero's and a very important sort of part of the liberation theology group in of priests in El Salvador. And he was just, I don't know, took me under his wing or whatever, and was shepherding me around to various meetings with women's groups, with victims groups, with the organization he had founded, Pro Buscada, which tries to reunite and continues to try to reunite children who were kidnapped essentially in El Salvador and adopted out of El Salvador with their families in El Salvador. And everywhere I went, all anybody wanted to do was tell me their stories. Every place, like if I was in a lobby of a, you know, somewhere at the University of Central America, people would just come up to me and want to tell me about what happened. And I felt like this was just a thing that people felt like they couldn't really talk about before. And here was this lawyer from the United States coming down to talk about the case and tell everybody what happened. And it just sort of like tapped into this vein that obviously had only been, you know, scabbed over, but was really there, which was, you know, how to get any kind of accountability for what happened. And so I feel like the courtroom did become, and we could have probably used it, done it better, you know, in terms of how we, I mean, there were times and we'd be in a courtroom and there'd be like four people in the audience or whatever. And we'd be going like, nobody even knows what we're doing, you know? And there could have been better ways probably for us to try to bring more people into the process. But I think that, you know, in terms of sort of all the indices of what you look at for why this is important, you know, how it affects victims, how it redounds in the home country, the so-called Pinochet effect, you know, just opportunity for some court to make a recognition of the liability and responsibility of key actors, using the court as a place to get at least some part of the full story, to elaborate the story. I mean, I think one of the things that's so impressive about Matt's book is that it really shows you the texture of these investigations that have to happen to do these cases. And there are very, very few vehicles that really show that in a way that you actually want to read and are really interested in. but also to enlarge this fuller truth about what happened with Romero. And to, even though it couldn't necessarily be brought in the courtroom, we were discovering it through the work that we did and through the investigation that was carried out. So I think there are the multiplicity of vectors that are kind of the classic ones that people, you know, who write about and think about this stuff have been fulfilled to some extent. As I say, I don't want to overclaim, you know, there's one guy sitting in jail, a former Vice Minister of Defense of El Salvador, Montano, is, you know, to some extent through the work that, or through a large extent, I want to take credit for that, that CJ has done on the Jesuit Massacre case. This is a guy who's been incarcerated for close to 4 years now in a U.S. jail. It's a complicated story, which I can explain if anybody wants to hear it. But so it's not really about criminal justice per se, but it is about having a court and having a judge and having a jury proclaim a finding that can reverberate, you know, most importantly back in the home country, but elsewhere.
Ray, do you want to come in on this?
I'm not sure I have a lot to add. I guess as I think about it, there's an effect on it. You'll never see it directly, but look, I think a lot of thugs, dictators, call them what you will, human rights abusers around the world are probably aware of these cases, and they know that you're not going to get away with it maybe in the United States. And I remember when I was in Bosnia arguing, you know, that was before the court was set up, you know, there needs to be a court to try some of these people. And I think there's RA, which you, of course, dedicated your whole life to, and that's building up this concept of there's going to be some kind of a legal system that deals with these people. And I think every case probably is an accretion, if you will, and it kind of getting across this idea that there is kind of a larger system of justice and the ICC and the places like that. So I'm sure this resonates. I'm not sure how many African dictators and thugs have read about this case, but I'm sure more than you realize, and they probably think, you know, maybe it's not so safe to go to the United States.
No, although I would say that when a court imposed a 50-year sentence on Charles Taylor, that resonated with quite a lot of African political leaders. Matt?
Yeah, maybe I'll just add one more point. Certainly, Patty has said it very well. With all the cases, but particularly, I think, with the Romero case, of course, you know, this was not being done in the United States in isolation, right? This was something that our Salvadoran colleagues wanted to see done and wanted to see done seriously. Obviously, we have a panel of people from the United States tonight, but this was all being done in absolute arm in arm with people in El Salvador who, of course, face a lot more danger and uncertainty than anything we ever face. And there was, you know, there, and I do include a few conversations in the book, you know, about the interest in looking at the United States as a venue, you know, to be able to push these kinds of cases forward, and particularly on Archbishop Romero's case. You had the amnesty law in full effect at that time, and when there actually had been attempts in the 80s to try and do something, those were scuttled by Davison and others. So there, you know, I think particularly in the Romero case, there was a strong interest among, you know, human rights experts in El Salvador to see a case like this proceed in the United States. And so I think that maybe ties in a little bit with what Patty was saying there. So I just wanted to add that point.
Before we open it up for questions, what do you anticipate as a result of the decision of the Salvadoran Supreme Court to invalidate the amnesty law? Can we now expect that there might be some late in the day prosecutions in El Salvador itself?
I mean, I think there are probably people in this room who can may be able to answer that better than I can. I'll give you the line that I've been using, but I would be very interested to hear Patty and Ray's take, and also others to perhaps continue the conversation. And in fact, I think Patty and I had a conversation about this. My book was going into production, and I had, you know, written a bit of a conclusion, talking about the amnesty law still being in effect, and then it was invalidated, and I had to figure out very quickly what I wanted to say about that. And Patty and I talked, and I think Patty said, "I think you're a little too pessimistic. Let's not forget that there have been times when, you know, there's a crack in the ice and things do proceed." Certainly several years ago, many of us were talking about Guatemala and that nothing was ever going to happen there. And lo and behold, imperfect as it's been, there have been, some cases in Guatemala. So I do think, look, you've got the reopening of the El Mazote case. I think that there is optimism that some of these cases can start to slowly move along. I'm less optimistic with Archbishop Romero's case, first of all, because at least so far I don't know of any particular movement on that. I think it's a case that requires even more political will than perhaps some of the other cases, because of the political issue with the Arena Party, but also because if you follow the Romero assassination to what I think is its logical end, you are implicating extremely powerful people in El Salvador. And I know in military cases you might be doing the same, but here we are talking about early members of the Arena Party, very wealthy families in El Salvador. And I think that it is going to be difficult for anybody to have the political will or to generate enough support to push that forward. So I'm less optimistic on Archbishop Romero's case. That being said, certainly it's helpful that he's soon going to be named a saint. And perhaps that can be a bit of a groundswell. But I will say, I'm extremely cautiously optimistic, but I'm also on the Romero case myself, not holding my breath at this moment.
Patty, do you want to add to that?
I don't have too much to add other than to say that, I think what I'm trying to learn from this experience and what's going on in El Salvador now is that the civil society organizations were so completely decimated by state repression. And it's taken a long time for the civil society organizations to reconstitute themselves. And what I'm seeing now is this younger generation of young lawyers, people in their early to mid 30s who are taking up the gauntlet of what they refer to as the historic crimes. And they're people who are working every day on prison conditions and police brutality and everything else that's going on in El Salvador, but they have this kind of really, in their heart's place for what, they heard about and know about through their own families. And so they're picking up the gauntlet, but they're incredibly under-resourced, incredibly understaffed. I mean, to think that the lawyers would play the kind of role that civil society organizations have been playing in Guatemala in really pushing forward cases the way that it is possible in a civil law system is a little inconceivable without more infusion of resources, because we know what it takes to do one of these cases. And for El Mazote, which is the biggest massacre that occurred during the conflict, and even the most forensically, there was exhumation of the mass grave sites and forensic evidence, et cetera, still is a gargantuan task. And so my feeling is that, you know, those of us who've sort of like walked alongside the people who were the victims in, you know, during the conflict, it like behooves us to support these young lawyers who are trying to take up the gauntlet, but with like, you know, a arm tied behind their backs, basically, in terms of the resources and access they have to be able to really press these cases properly. So, you know, I do think it's something that's going to have to come from people really making it happen. It is not, the FMLN government is not going to willingly just be like, oh, the law, you know, the amnesty law was overturned, so let's forge ahead. It's going to have to be the civil society organizations and lawyers and, you know, inside, outside collaborations or whatever that are going to just keep pressing maybe these exemplar cases that are, you know, El Mazote in particular, I think because of the nature of the crime and the massiveness of the crime, but also quite frankly, because the Minister of Defense of El Salvador at the time, Guillermo Garcia, was one of the subjects of our litigation, was deported back to El Salvador about a year ago. And he is the person who, you know, said that the whole crime was made up, then blamed it on the FMLN in a sort of classic pattern of deception and cover up. And he's there now, you know. So the actual person in my mind who has to be held accountable for that crime is in El Salvador. So, but, you know, just trying to be a realist, you know, I think that people are going to need a lot of support and a lot of help, you know, from civil society and funders and whatever in the U.S. to make this happen so that they have the capacity to really, you know, push these cases.
I just wanted to very quickly add to what Patty said about resources, which is such an important point to make here. You know, in our case, in the Romero case, we had basically a one-year full court press on this case, and you know, some of the things that have been written about the book called us a ragtag team of lawyers. Well, maybe inside CJ's offices we were a bit ragtag, but in fact we had a powerful team. Aside from everybody in El Salvador we were working with, we were teamed up with one of the biggest law firms in the United States. We were working with Jim Mintz and his wonderful investigation team who was working pro bono. We had an enormous, powerful team working on this case. And in the end, we still didn't end up naming any of the other defendants that we wanted to name in the case. And so I just wanted to add that is to, in thinking about the resources, I think is such a crucial thing in addition to all the other challenges that there are.
I would just say, I know.
El Mazote, I don't know if you get Garcia, but I think there's probably a couple of colonels or majors out there you could probably get on your way up to the top that would have a very salutary effect. And I don't think I'd go after Garcia. You know who they are. We know who they are. Yeah. They're there. And I think you could get those with the kind of work you've done fairly easily.
Okay, I'm going to open it up, but before I do, I'm supposed to remind you that if you speak up, you will be recorded, and we will do something with the recording, so be aware that you're giving up your privacy to a degree if you take part in the conversation. And if you want to ask a question, there's a microphone on my right in the front of the room. And if you'd go to that microphone and identify yourself, we can take comments, but not too lengthy comments as well as questions. Go ahead.
My name's Kate Doyle, and I'm with the National Security Archive. First of all, Matt, terrific book. You managed to sort of get this tease of a thriller, as well as the anatomy of government-supported death squad operations, and that's a very, very hard thing to depict, and it's wonderfully told in your book. So congratulations.
Thank you.
I want to challenge you guys a tiny bit on the sort of limited answers you gave to Arye's question about what do you think, why does this matter to chase after dictators and human rights abusers and find them accountable even 10, 20, or 30 years later. I mean, this is a comment, but open for your reactions. One thing you didn't mention is you're both training and animando, how do you say that? Giving enthusiasm to exciting, encouraging young lawyers who work in human rights. Yes, in El Salvador, but in the United States, I know young lawyers from CAJA have gone on to illustrious careers in Canada. Matt is someone sitting at the table.
The illustrious Canadian.
You know, and not just focusing on Latin America cases, but cases of all kinds. Almudena Bernabeu, who's working through a new organization in Spain. I mean, I think one of the things that these cases do over time is build up this incredible kind of infrastructure of knowledge and experience that is passed down through human rights law clinics and law schools and law interns and all kinds of people who then go on and spread the word and spread the good deeds. And that, I think, is why it's worth continuing these kinds of cases, you know, until we drop. I don't know if you guys have a comment or a reaction, but I just wanted to say that.
Reaction to that. I derive my own thinking on this to a significant extent from a book that a German philosopher, Karl Jaspers, wrote in the aftermath of World War II. The book in German is Die Schuldfrage, The Guilt Question, and it's translated into to English as the question of German guilt. Jaspers argues that that criminal guilt is individual, and you can only deal with it on an individual basis, and you have to hold accountable those who are criminally guilty. But he also talks about various other forms of guilt, and one of those forms of guilt is political guilt. And he says that's collective. He says that a society as a whole allows certain things to take place, and no one contemporary society is a hermit living in the mountains. All of us take some part in the political process, and that we have to come to grips with our participation to the degree that we have allowed these kinds of crimes to take place. And in order to do that, we have to engage in an acknowledgement of the crimes, and it's important that the whole society should take part in the acknowledgement of that of the crimes. And if one wants to build a society with democratic responsibility in the aftermath of these terrible things, that process of acknowledgement needs to take place. In fact, I think Jaspers had a big effect eventually in Germany, and perhaps more than in any other country. There has been a kind of collective acceptance of responsibility in Germany for the crimes of the Nazi era. And I believe that the democratic process in Germany, perhaps as exemplified by Angela Merkel and her policies with respect to refugees and her international policies generally, reflects that kind of German acknowledgement of the political responsibility for the crimes of the Nazi era. It was Angela Merkel wasn't alive at the time the Nazi crimes were committed, but she still feels a kind of political responsibility as a German to acknowledge those crimes and behave in a democratic fashion. And so from my standpoint, if a society which has had as much criminality as took place in El Salvador in the 1980s is to develop as a decent society, there has to be that collective acknowledgement. And to have wealthy families still today as the elite of El Salvador who had a role in making it possible for the actual killers to engage in these kinds of crimes, if that kind of a society is to be transformed, there needs to be the process of facing up to the terrible things that that did happen in that country. And from my standpoint, pursuing these kinds of things very long afterwards is justified first and foremost by the need to try to transform a society of that sort. At any rate, if anybody wants to challenge that, I'm happy to hear it. Go ahead.
Jim Mintz, my investigative firm played a microscopic role in the story that Matt's book tells so well. And I wanted to focus on the investigative aspects of the story you tell. I think the investigation was fascinating and excellent, and I think you tell it in a fascinating and excellent way. So I guess it stands for a point that's important to me, that human rights work is largely investigative work, and I've always viewed CJA and Human Rights Watch and others as basically investigative organizations, and to the extent you guys are also lawyers, you're investigative lawyers, and to the extent Ray is a reporter, he's an investigative reporter. And so I guess my question is, what do you feel you've learned, or what should we learn as investigative human rights activists that we can take to other human rights situations about the investigative aspects?
Just full disclosure, I work for Jim or with Jim, teaching a course, investigative course at Columbia, the journalism school. But as you're asking a question, I mean, I'm thinking about El Masote, of course, which everybody brings up, and when I reported about that.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to El
Masote? Sure, because I guess it relates the answer. I mean, I'm assuming you all know what El Masote is. No? Well, it was a massacre in El Salvador, and the full circle, it's what brought the attacks on me that R.A. referred to a while ago. I was a reporter in El Salvador. I'd been a lawyer, like these guys, and had dropped out. Didn't know what I was going to do with my life, and went down to Central America. And as I say, I got to El Salvador on Sunday, and the nuns were killed on Tuesday, and the rest is history, and the New York Times started letting me write for them, much to their later regret. And I don't know, when was it, December, whatever it was, I was down there, and I wanted to go in with the guerrillas. Naturally, you would. I mean,
Morazan province,
right,
in the northern part of El Salvador, was controlled by the guerrillas, and the massacre took place in a region that, let's say, American diplomats didn't go to because because it was a guerrilla-controlled territory. But there were also villages in that area which were trying to keep away from the conflict, and that was an important part of it.
But the important thing is, as a journalist, I wanted to go in with the guerrillas. Now, you know, that later that brought accusations that you're a guerrilla sympathizer. Come on, it was the biggest story around. We were expending, as Patty pointed out, more money there than in any other country with the exception of Israel and Egypt. Naturally, as a reporter, you want to go in and find out who are we fighting? What's it about? Who are these Marxist guerrillas? Have they been to Cuba? So I went, you know, I tried, every journalist wanted to go in, and because I had the imprimatur of the New York Times, obviously, the guerrillas arranged for me to go in, along with Susan Micellis, who was a terrific photojournalist, of course, all of you know her work. And we went, and then as I was a young, naive journalist at the time, I called a friend of mine, Alma Guillermo Prieto, who was at the Washington Post. People have said to me, you called a competitor to tell her you were going in? I did, and I'm glad I did for obvious reasons that will become obvious later. Anyhow, we went in. We went in with the guerrillas. We did not know about the massacre.
How did you get into Morazan province?
Well, I had dinner with Susan the other night. We were talking about it, and we were trying to remember. We went to a hotel. It was at Christmas time, and we were here, and I got the call, and you can go, and we went to Honduras, and then we took a car out of Honduras, and the first night, you know, we were supposed to meet somebody on the road, and they didn't show up, and so we had to do it again, and then we went across, and I remember this, going across a river with my backpack over my head and a full moon, and I thought, this is either romantic, part of me thought it was pretty romantic, like backpacking in the Sierras, which I'd done, the other part of me brought back a memories of Vietnam, where I had been a Marine, thinking, my God, am I setting up for a sniper attack with that full moon? And we went in, and we were, you know, eventually, and I still don't remember, or Susan remembers better, how many days we were in there, traveling around in guerrilla-held territory, interviewing all kinds of people. I mean, this was a real, journalistically, this was a scoop. This was an incredible opportunity. And remember, there were not even sat phones, so I had to, well after I had been in and gotten out, before I could write the story. And we were taken to this village where you know, we saw this the horrors, and it was really, really horrible. I can still see it. I can see the spilled coffee beans and a peasant lying there and children's toys under the huts and the houses that had been collapsed, and the bodies and the bones. It was horrific. It was pretty horrible. It was pretty clear something had happened. So when I got out, because again, you couldn't write about it from inside. When I got out, I wrote about it. And it was on the front page of the New York Times. And that's when the Reagan administration, as well as Salvador, said it never happened. There hadn't been a massacre, and besides that, not this number of people have been killed. And besides that, and then the Wall Street Journal said this was a propaganda exercise, and I was a reporter out on a limb.
A few days after the story appeared, there was a congressional hearing a few days after, and I was one of the witnesses scheduled to testify at the hearing, and the people who preceded me were the administration spokespersons. Tom Enders was the Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, and Elliot Abrams was the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. And they preceded me on the witness stand and essentially said it never happened, that this had talked about so many people being killed. There weren't so many people who lived in this village in the first instance. They ignored the fact that it involved several different hamlets, and not just the one hamlet known as Almazote, and in a variety of ways they conveyed the impression that it never took place. And at that stage, I had the stories that Ray had written for the New York Times and that Alma had written for the Washington Post, but we had not ourselves been to the place, didn't have independent information on the case at that time. And so I feel I was rather weaker than I should have been in rebutting the testimony of Enders and Abrams at that time. I will tell one story, which maybe I shouldn't tell, but I will tell it anyway. And that is, I had started with a friendly relationship with Elliot Abrams, which deteriorated over a period of time. And one day he called me to yell at me about one of Ray Bonner's stories. And then he signed off the phone conversation in a way that was quite unexpected. He said, "I wish I could say the same about Almazote." Any rate.
But, you know, but Jim, back, it wasn't really investigative reporting as, you know, I've heard you teaching it to these kids and very, very effectively. I mean, I was just doing basic reporting. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to go interview the military or et cetera. It's obviously I asked the government for a comment, et cetera, but these are the guys that really do the deep, deep, deep digging into these stories. But at that time, I think Arye Nair was, I didn't know Arye at that time. I'd met him, I think it was shortly after that. He was, Human Rights Watch was Arye Nair, one other, Cynthia Brown, was it? Or
yeah.
A secretary. Human Rights Watch was in. Three people in an office. Now look at it today.
I just wanted to add a little bit on the investigation end because I think it's really, really important. And I think, I don't know how many times, you know, we sat around a table going like, we need an investigator, we need an investigator. You know, you guys, and then otherwise it was us. And we were sort of like, oh my God, we're the investigators, but we're also the lawyers, you know, investigator, lawyer. You know, one of the things I feel like, you know, I've been privileged to sort of reflect on all this stuff so much over the years is that it's really important to think about this stuff forensically. And, you know, how it is going to be used in a case is different from other ways in which you might treat evidence, be it actual forensic evidence from a, you know, crime scene, or be other forms of forensic evidence, and also just trying to think creatively about what is evidence. So we have been in a situation throughout all the work that we've done where we have no cache of documents from El Salvador. We have very, very few Salvadorans who have, you know, broken the code of silence. That every military person was trained in, you know, you scratch each other's back and all the way up the chain of command. And so we haven't been in that situation. And one of the things, just to pick back up on, you know, Kate's question, and thank you very much, because, of course, as a, you know, professor and a lawyer, you know, that's a huge part of it for me is educating the next generation or next generations now, I guess, is that we ended up using U.S. government declassified documents. Thank you, National Security Archive. We worked with amazing people, including Kate, at National Security Archives throughout the process. And to actually, though, the problem is you're sort of retrofitting this amazing cache of information from the U.S. government, but you're having to do it in this way where you're not really indicting the U.S. government for its role, because the U.S.'s role is irrelevant, quote unquote, to the evidence in your case. So you're having to figure out, how do I take what I've learned from literally tens of thousands of documents that, you know, Matt, me, Ken, other people, like, you know, scoured for purposes of litigation, and make it understandable to a judge and a jury. And that whole process has been a kind of an amazing thing, but also just to think about it as evidence for a trial, evidence that you're going to be able to bring into court. So I think that there's all the questions embedded in sort of how you carry out investigations, what you're trying to find, but also how you have to think about it as an actual piece of evidence that's going to be admitted into a court of law, just complicate it. And sometimes having both the hats at the same time, you know, is not such an easy, you know, thing to carry within yourself. There are many conversations I can remember where we like wanted to, especially around this issue of the U.S.'s role, you know, where we would be like, we can't do these cases and not be talking about the U.S.'s role. We can't, you know, and then it would be like, but we're not going to be able to talk about the U.S. role. And then what's that going to do? And how's that going to affect a jury in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005? This is a time after 9/11. And we had to be very conscious of how a jury was going to interpret a story, the narrative of which on the other side is we were fighting terrorism. And I was recently going back and looking at a transcript from one of our cases, and I was like baffled at how many times the defendant in his testimony had used the word terrorist. And, you know, that language was appropriated, so we had to, you know, figure our way around that. So the investigation evidence paradigm, you know, and where they are on the ends of the spectrum, I think is something we still could learn a lot more about and need to be talking more about and writing more about so that, you know, we can be teaching future generations about how to think about it.
Hi, I'm Leonor Arteaga. I'm Salvadorian, and I work at the Due Process of Law Foundation, DPLF, a human rights organization based in D.C. And before that, I worked at Pro Búsqueda and Tutela Legal, and I've been dealing with all the impunity struggle in El Salvador for a long time now. And I really want to thank you, Mark, for your excellent book and also for bringing light to this case and this figure, a leader for not only for Salvadorian people but from the world, and all the previous work that you have done, Patty, and of course Raymond Bonner. Is an honor to meet all of you. And I completely agree with what you were saying about the challenges that civil society is facing now and victims groups in El Salvador, because they have lost their capacity to have like a really big impact, the lack of resources, of human resources, financial resources. They don't have any fresh ideas anymore. But at the same time, after the decision on the amnesty law, there's like a renewed interest, and the agenda has been moving. The El Mozote case, the criminal investigation on El Mozote case was reopened, but also another case, another massacre, the El Calabozo massacre. And recently, the Attorney General finally had created a special unit for investigating historic cases. He doesn't really know how to do it, but at least he has created this special unit. So definitely there's a new moment in El Salvador. There's also a discussion on how to search people that disappeared during the war. There's a commission that will be set up soon. But at the same time, El Salvador, as probably everybody here knows, is facing with really high rates of crime, and has like a really bad economy, so the social space for discussing and debating the issues that happened 30 years ago is really small. And I would like a comment from you on how to engage society in general now, taking into account this context that gives, it looks like it gives really small space for the historical agenda.
It's a very difficult question. The one thing that I would say is that I don't think the difficulties of El Salvador today are unconnected to the history of El Salvador. That, you know, one of the consequences of the conflict in El Salvador is a lot of people, as were mentioned, became refugees to the United States, and they included a lot of young men who didn't want to go into the military and didn't want to join the guerrillas, and you know, some of them ended up in jails in the United States, and I think there's quite a lot of evidence that some of the gangs that have been responsible for the violence in El Salvador developed in the Los Angeles County Jail and other institutions where they spent time in the United States. So those people were deported back to El Salvador after they got out of jail. And the gangs have had a kind of Salvadoran American connection. They exist in both places, and a lot of the difficulties in El Salvador today relate to the gang warfare, and the very high murder rate is related to the gangs. So the armed conflict in El Salvador and the human rights abuses in El Salvador disrupted the whole society, and a lot of the conflict was not limited to the combatants. It focused on the civilians. There was a certain point, for example, when the Salvadoran Air Force was bombing and strafing peasants in the Salvadoran countryside. They called the peasants the masas, and they said that the guerrillas only could exist with the support of the masas. They got their food, they got their medical care from the masas. Again, to tell stories about El Salvador, I can recall going to El Salvador at a certain point, and one of my early stops on every visit that I made to El Salvador was to the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Because the ICRC people knew a great deal about what was taking place, and they kept confidences, but if I was going off in the wrong direction, they would wave their finger at me, and I would know that's not a good thing to pursue. And then one time that I went, they were more willing to be forthcoming than any other time. And they told me that they had stopped the use of mobile clinics in territory where the guerrillas operated, because they said when they had the mobile clinics people would gather from a large area to get medical care at these mobile clinics. And then when the mobile clinic left, the Salvadoran Air Force would come and strafe the people who had gathered to go to those mobile clinics. And they said they had to discontinue the mobile clinics because they couldn't subject the Salvadoran peasants to that kind of risk of death from going to them. And I asked them, could I raise that question with the U.S. ambassador? And they said yes. And the ICRC didn't ordinarily allow me to say anything about what I had learned from them, but on this occasion they gave me permission. And the U.S. ambassador at that particular moment was the best of the people who were sent as ambassador to El Salvador. It was Tom Pickering, and I went to Pickering and talked about it. And Pickering did get a stop to that. But the idea that you would attack civilians going to a medical clinic and that you would strafe people like that is, you know, unbelievable. And yet that was the kind of attack on civilians that was taking place during that period. And, you know, people fled the country. It disrupted the whole country. And I think the legacy of the gangs is to a significant extent, a consequence of the kinds of things that was done, were done during the conflict. And I think if El Salvador is to even overcome the kind of violence it suffers from today, it's got to recognize its past. It's got to come to grips with its past, and making those connections for people may have to be part of the way in which the society does come to grips with its past.
I was basically going to make that last point there that I agree wholeheartedly with, and that takes us perhaps full circle to the question of why is it important to pursue these cases decades later? It's because the linkages don't end. If we're talking about those connections between what's going on today versus 30 to 35 years ago, in part those things are still happening. In part we're in a situation that we are in El Salvador because there's never been accountability for what happened previously. And so that perhaps connects those two points up, which I think is fundamentally important. It is something that, documenting, looking at a current situation is through a lens of what came before is particularly important. And I think that's certain, and maybe that also ties in with the investigation piece, is understanding that history and being able to understand how the past has impacted the present, I think is of critical importance.